Meta bows to MAGA. You heard that right. This is the focus group.
They're all business, except when they're not. It's the focus group with Tim Bennett and John Nash.
Welcome to the focus group. Tim Bennett here, as always, with my good friend and co-host, Mr. John T. Nash. We are the focus group. Learn all about us at focusgroupradio.com. Be sure to like and follow us there. You may hear some, we've got a couple of notes from listeners, but John and I are on a network now called Believe, or the focus group is on a network now called Believe, as is our podcast, TFG Unbuttoned. And so you may hear some commercials that have been put in on and off. You know, someone's got to pay the bills. Keep this going after 16 years. So hopefully it's not too much of a distraction. They're usually played at the beginning and the end of the show. And John, I opened up with this Meta bows to MAGA, which is our story in Shop Talk today about Meta or Facebook. I don't like the name Meta. Do you?
He came up with that. Remember, they were trying to change the company because it was going to be. He was a few years ago. They were doing the Metaverse. You were going to sign on and wear goggles and have an avatar. That's where they came up with Meta from. And then they kind of dropped the Metaverse because it was so clumsy and horrible. Yeah.
But why not keep it Facebook? Like, why not keep it Twitter instead of X? What is the benefit of going to X? Nobody calls it X.
Well, if you
nobody calls it Meta.
No. And if you spend $44 billion to have the new toy on the block, you're not going to keep the old name. All smart money would say, hey, let's just, because everybody calls it Twitter. Nobody calls it X, right?
Or it's the formerly known as, right? Yeah. X, formerly known as Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, could have been Q, could have been anything, I guess. M.
Could have been
T,
pi.
Pi.
The symbol for pi, right? 3.14.
So how are you doing, Mr. Nash? You doing well?
Doing very well. We're solidly into 2025. I have a joke I use for the first 4 days of every new year, maybe five I can squeak by with, but it's like you'll say to somebody, Happy New Year, and they're like, Happy New Year. I said, it feels strangely like the old year. But then when you're 10 days or 15 days in, it doesn't feel like, now you're in 2025, so.
Oh, there you go. We didn't do New Year's resolutions.
I do the same one every year. I do it privately, and I heard it from someone, I forget who, years ago, and it's, don't suffer fools gladly, and don't let them waste your time. And there's a third one I've added to that, which is Steve Jobs is quoted, or has been rumored to have said that he used to wake up or look in the mirror every day and say the following: if this is the last day of your life, was it a good day? Was it a day worth living? And if you put everything in those terms, like if this is the last day, yeah, we have typical days. Sometimes we're off, we run errands, we go to the grocery store, we do things. But I think he meant on par. Was it positive? Did you help somebody? Did you feel good? You know. So don't suffer fools gladly. And if this is your last day, was it a good one? Make it a good one.
I guess it's like Erin McHugh's book, One Good Deed, right?
She tried to do one good deed a day.
That's kind of jolting because I think there's days you just piss away sometimes. I do.
Oh, totally. Totally.
So yeah. I don't know if it would be the best day.
Well, let's take, example would be, was it Thursday last week? I was like out of it. All day. The only time I felt good was when I did yoga, but the rest of the day I had a headache, I was tired, and I realized that I must not have slept well the night before because by 7 o'clock that day or eight, I was toast. I went to bed early. Felt great Friday, but you're right. If that was my last day on earth, the Thursday when I had headaches, I felt it wasn't feeling good. I don't know.
I had a crazy dream. I got to remember it, and I should write it down, but I had a crazy dream about you and I doing something crazy. I'll have to remember what it was.
Oh, you were in a dream of mine that I had last week. It was really bizarre, and I'll tell you why it was bizarre, because nothing bad happened in the dream, but you and I were being pursued by three women. Yeah, there's the face. Yeah, like
this one might have been close to that too. You and I were trying to get away from something. That's funny, because the dream I had was, but I did not recognize the place, and I did not recognize the people. But we were trying to get away from something, which was odd.
Mine took place in some old house, and there was nothing threatening about it. But we were being badgered, not in a bad way, but please come here, please do this. And then in the end of the dream, one of the women in the dream, I don't even remember what she looked like. She was like, you know, but we like you. And then I woke up. I'm like, okay, I'm glad I'm liked, but I have no idea what that meant. That it was a nonsense dream, right?
Sometimes when you wake up, you're thankful it was a dream. You're like, oh, I think that was a dream. But it's funny that sometimes you don't remember things well enough. I don't remember things well enough sometimes. So I got to do a
better
job.
Ago when I had therapy, my therapist would beg me to keep a pad of paper by the bed. And if I had a dream, to immediately write it down. Now, there are mornings when I wake up and I don't feel like picking up a pen. And I certainly don't feel like writing down what was on my mind of the dreams. But one time I did write a dream down. I forget how it went. And I came in and I told him the dream. And he said, well, let's look at that dream. I said, well, why are we looking at it? It's a dream. Well, it's your subconscious processing. I said, no, I'm not sure about that. I said, because I woke up earlier in the morning, went back to sleep, had this dream and woke up. So it's one of those dreams that you weren't really in deep REM sleep. You were surfacey. But then he says, those are the ones I like talking about because those are the ones that are being definitely driven by your subconscious. And he unwound it a bit and it all came back to fear.
Do you think
if you live on
true?
Earth, it's like the movie Defending Your Life. If you live down here on Earth, it's all about fear. You're going to die. You're going to be eaten. You're going to have enough this or that, you know, fear.
You're going to have enough to live. You know, you have food, blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Nash, what caught your eye this week?
What caught your eye? Here's what Tim and John found.
Tim, I think this is right up your alley, and I'm hoping you haven't heard of it, but I read it. It's exactly how Caught My Eye works. I was reading an article about a documentary that was rated as one of the most overlooked documentaries of 2024. And I'm like, well, Tim and I love documentaries. It's about a movie called Look Into My Eyes. And it's about psychics.
Oh, my God.
So the documentary is currently now on HBO Max. It's a film by the company called A24. They do a bunch of great documentaries. And it's directed by a woman named Lana Wilson. And it was released this January. But she began this project way back in, I think it was 2016. So it was after the day after Trump was elected for his first term. She woke up and she said, I had a very depressing, horrifying night, like a lot of people did. Wilson recounted. She admitted that she'd never been taken psychics very seriously, believing that it was the kind of entertainment one might expect to see at a bachelorette party, but nevertheless found herself forking over the $5 to visit one. I immediately felt incredibly emotional, almost like I was looking in a mirror. I had this thought that there is something so vulnerable about going to ask a complete stranger for help and advice, and I thought, this is a really powerful experience. Following her reading, when conversing casually with the psychic, Wilson was captivated by the range of motivations that brought everyday people into such a spiritual place: loneliness, failed romances, strained family relations. So she began working on the document, this idea, and she called it Look Into My Eyes, but it got sidelined first by COVID and then by a documentary she did called Miss Americana, and that's about Taylor Swift, actually. So she returned to this, finally finished it. It profiles and looks at, I want to say, 6 or 7 psychics in the New York City area. And Bob and I watched this on Saturday night. It's about an hour and 20 minutes. And I'll tell you, too, the documentary earned a 90% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and the critics have pretty much fallen into the same exact category. I'll give you 2 critiques. This is from Slate, written by Sam Adams. Whether or not you believe these psychics are communing with the dead, or in one case, with the spirits of still-living animals, because it was an animal psychic she profiled as well, the interactions with their clients feel genuinely emotional in a way that is hard to dismiss entirely. And then Robert Butler from Cinematic Scene said the following: Look Into My Eyes won't convince anyone of anything, but the film does suggest that psychic readings may provide emotional benefits for both parties, irregardless of any paranormal implications. Maybe we're looking at it all wrong. It's therapy. So I had read this, what I just read to you, I read this before we watched the movie. We started watching it, and I tell you, that hour and 20 flew by, because the stories of the psychics themselves are just as intriguing as the people they're reading or trying to help. And it's on Max. I looked for it on our partner Deep Discount to see if it was available currently. It's not currently available as a packaged media. Maybe it will be someday. But it left me remembering my psychic experiences, and you've had a couple too, right?
Right. Well, I was going to say you were skeptical,
mm-hmm.
but we had one psychic on. I think her name was Carol London.
That's it, Carol London.
That you talked to, and I remember
you gave a reading for my birthday.
Right, and you would come out, and you were shocked. I think yes. about what she mm-hmm. knew, or and I never asked you what she shared, but you said there were things that obviously only you knew. So I was wondering, so did you, after watching this documentary, was it trying to convince you that psychics are real, or was it?
No. You know, what she did with I think it's such a well-parsed question that you ask, because like the critics said, you're not going to walk away from this documentary thinking one way or the other, but you are going to be impressed by the emotional connection that happens between the client and the psychic. And like, so that time that Tim is mentioning, like many years ago, we were on Sirius Satellite Radio. We had Carol on the show. And when you have a psychic on a live radio show, phones go crazy. They light up.
You don't have to
like
do anything. Just answer the phone.
And afterward, Tim said, hey, before we go to lunch, because we used to always have a tradition of having lunch, then we would take the train either to Philly or I would go upstate. He said, I arranged with Carol to sit with you. Was it like 20 minutes maybe or half hour?
Half hour, yeah.
And so she didn't know me she only knew me from the show. And even then, it's not like we were revealing personal information. We were just taking calls from listeners. We go into the room, and this is about, I want to say it was about 4 or 5 months after my dad passed away. And I sit in this chair opposite her, and she sits, and she just is very quiet for a minute. She said, he's here. He's right over on your left side, and he wants you to know everything's fine. She starts to go on, and I finally said, who? I don't even know if I mentioned this to you, Tim. And she said, your father. And I know you had a relationship. And that's why when I walked out and I saw Tim afterwards, I'm like, I don't know what to think, because
right.
either she invented a story that was she was so lucky she hit the target, or something else, right? Like, and then when we had that pet psychic on, the British pet psychic, she nailed both our cats, and I think she nailed Trixie and Spike too, like behaviors, right?
Right. Well, the time with Spike, she had said that Spike doesn't like when you wash the blue blanket, and Brian happened to be listening to the show. I said, I don't have a blue blanket. Remember, he called into the show and said, I'm sitting here with Spike on your sofa. You've got a blue blanket.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Spike doesn't like when you wash it. And he used to like, and then she had said, and Spike likes when your friend comes. She wears sensible shoes from Chicago named Mary or something, swings a golf club. It was Mary Ann. And how Spike and Trixie said they like to just sit and listen because we talk all day and get nothing done. And they just like to sit around and hear us talk. So they were that nailed it. Yeah.
So I think you'll enjoy this if you have Max.
Oh, I'm definitely going to watch it.
Look into my eyes. There was one psychic in particular that I was really intrigued by when I was watching him do the reading, because he was reading somebody and every single thing he said got a response from them in the positive, like, oh my God, you figured this out. And the pet psychic, I'm not so sure about. You know, you'll see what I mean when you watch it. But I think the critics are right. There is an emotional component to this that intrigues me. And I remember once, again, way, way years ago when I had therapy for a while, I did go to a psychic named Patty Canova. She was on 34th Street. She would tape record the sessions. So you had that. And I remember going to therapy a week later and I'm like, oh my God, I went to this psychic and here's what she said. And Terry was a therapist. He's sitting there with a pad of paper and a pen, and he just puts the pen down and he listens carefully. He goes, well, that's a really great experience. You know, he goes, did it help you out? And I'm like, well, no, all these things are going to happen. And by the end of the session, he made me realize that it was sort of like what this movie's talking about. It acted as a form of therapy. And I liked it.
gave you hope. Your therapist must have loved you because you were give and take.
I wonder if you ever did therapy. You'd probably sit like you had to have that pulled out of you, right?
Well, I think friends, you know, you're a therapist for me. I mean, friends are therapists to you as well.
Oh, Tim is the chairman and CEO of my board of directors. If I have like 4 or 5 people in my life that I bounce thing off of, the first person that gets bounced off is Tim.
Then you decide whether you're going to take the advice or not, but usually you listen. And meaning just in general, we listen to your friends or their thoughts. But I'll definitely put that on the list. The last one I watched on HBO Max was that Chimp Crazy. And you remember
you mean
that
the one where the people have them as pets?
Yes, and they're nuts. They're all nuts. So if you like that one about the tigers, where everybody had the tigers, remember?
Tiger King.
During the pandemic, this chimp one is equally as crazy.
But Tim, you watched another one on Netflix about a colony of actual chimpanzees.
Yes, like
apes.
Chimp Empire or something. That was scary.
They get violent and they're, tribal.
Well, the same thing happens in this.
Oh.
These chimps get violent and hurt people. But they, for some reason, these people just love them. They're wild animals. You have them in your house. They're going to bite and kill you. This one woman, it bit her ear off, but she still insisted she wanted to keep the chimp around. She still wanted to have another chimp. She went into the cage with the chimp, thought it was going to be nice and loving, and the thing attacked her. It's a nut. I don't know where they get their money from to house these things.
To support that? Yeah.
Anyway, it's a train wreck. And then I watched something else that was on from also on HBO, and I guess it came out in 2013. I didn't know about it, but they're essentially calling it Dirty Survivor, I guess, when I read the reviews afterwards. I knew nothing about it when I logged on and ended up binge-watching. It was called The Garden. Have you heard about this?
The Garden. Okay.
So these are people in North Carolina that decided to pick up and go to Missouri, but they're essentially living off the grid because the world's going to end.
If you were watching on video, the face Tim just made was, whoa.
So they're living in buses and dancing around with dirty feet and, eating garbage out of dumpsters. And I had to watch that. I couldn't stop watching it because I was so
You were so caught up in it, right?
Well, I just couldn't believe it. And there was no hierarchy within society. And everything had to be consensus. And one guy came in and said, there's got to be a leader. So now there's strife at the garden. But anyway, if you want to see a train wreck, that's another one, The Garden.
Oh, boy. Up. All right. Well, what caught your eye?
So mine can't be any vastly different. But I laugh because every once in a while we like to visit with our friend Kim Jong-un in North Korea, which, sadly...
The president's best friend.
Right, and sadly, they've, sent troops to Ukraine. But this headline says, North Korea's newest luxury mall opens an IKEA store, apparently without permission. So...
How do they do that?
Well, it's typical North Korea, So they said North Korea's newest luxury mall is now home to an IKEA store, giving wealthy residents of Pyongyang the opportunity to purchase the Swedish giant's flat-packed furniture for their own homes. But the store appears to be using IKEA branding and the IKEA brand name without permission, according to the Swedish furniture maker. They said, we do not have any presence in North Korea, nor do we have any official presence or relationship with the DPRK. We can't figure out where these goods came from. They believe they were bought and smuggled in from China. And the North Koreans put together their own little IKEA store. There's a picture there of on the side. So they said how they could tell is that when IKEA opens, if you've ever been to an IKEA store, right, you have to get into the maze to go through the upstairs to the downstairs, and you can't go back. There's a very set process of meandering through an IKEA store. This is just a bunch of IKEA stuff that they've placed on in a store within this luxury mall. What they said is also different. They're not so sure that it's all IKEA stuff. They think they might have just made copies of signs and did some kind of flat-packed, easy furniture to put together, to put on there. But North Korea's denying it, saying, no, in fact, it is IKEA. So, I laughed because I thought, North Korea is the Donald Trump of countries, right? And the rules don't apply. You do whatever you want. What are the consequences? What are the consequences? It reminds me of Team America, right, where Hans Bricks comes in and Team America, and he's
you're busting my balls, Hans.
Yeah, Hans, what are you doing? Where are your nuclear weapons, Kim Jong Il? We need your nuclear weapons. Oh, Hans, yeah, you're busting my balls, Hans. And he says, "You must show us where your nuclear weapons are, or your weapons of mass destruction." And Kim Jong Il says, "Or else." And then Hans Bricks says, "Or else we're going to write you a letter telling you how very angry we are with you." The UN.
Very angry letter, yeah.
"Or else the UN will be very, very angry with you and write a letter telling you how angry we are."
Now,
that's what it reminds me of.
Sidebar, right? Focus group movie is Team America. Like you and I, that movie, if you loved the Thunderbirds and you like puppetry and you love South Park and that kind of humor, then Team America is right up your alley.
Oh, it's so politically incorrect.
Do you watch it like once a year? I do.
Well, I went, I should post the clips too. I'll post this Hans Bricks clip Hans Bricks, how you doing, Hans?
And then when the Hans Brick puppet says, we're going to write you a letter, and the little feet are moving up and down, like the puppet's moving. I mean, it's visual and it's audio. It's just great. Yeah.
It's perfect. Anyway, so North Korea has denied that this stuff came from China. China's not saying anything. IKEA is trying to figure out where this stuff came from, but there's nothing much they can do from closing it down. They did say it appears that a number of Western brands have made an appearance at the at the luxury mall, despite all the sanctions. And they said the fact that there's very few Western brands that have any association with North Korea, and most things come in from China. So they said, though, it appears that there are several brands that have also made an appearance right next to IKEA, including Montblanc and Gucci.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So there's the Gucci
Blanc
store. So right next to IKEA, there's a Montblanc store and a Gucci store. So they know that these things are not, they're using these logos and these brands without permission. And they said what they think is happening is that there's some importer that has a deal worked out on the black market with China, and they're just bringing in either goods or fake goods and setting them up in this North Korea luxury mall. So if you're in North Korea, stop by the IKEA Gucci Mont Blanc store.
Speaking of which, Tim and I were at a conference. It was for the International Gay and Lesbian Travel Association, the IGLTA, and they had someone from the State Department who we actually thought was a really cool guy, nice guy, Paul. We actually had him on the show, I think, unless that was a small business guy. No, the State Department guy. So, Tim, we're standing at this one of those high top tables that you would at a cocktail thing where you could just rest your drink, but there's no, it's just a table. And we're talking to the guy, and Tim goes, hey, John and I want to go do a show in North Korea. We want to go see the subways and the whole thing. And the guy's listening, right? And didn't he say something like, well, you can go, but you may not come back?
Oh, he's very serious. He goes, you can't go. He goes, don't you remember, he was really scared. He said, you won't come home.
You won't come home.
You can't criticize anything there. You can't go there and talk freely. And I'm not so sure. Yeah, that was when we were in Brazil. We had said,
that's right.
We said, could you get us a visa to get to North Korea? North Korea!
We're imagining it's like the puppets from Team America, but he took us extremely seriously and made sure we would promise not to go to North Korea by the time he walked away from the high top.
That's like when I went to, in a different way, but somewhat similar, when we went to, I went to Finland with Rob Moran, and we went to the Hertz Rent-A-Car to get a rent-a-car, and we had to sign all these papers promising we would not go anywhere near Russia.
Really?
Or pick up Russian, right, because they were afraid Russians were stealing the cars, the Hertz cars, in Finland and take him into Russia. And then at one point, Rob and I at a restaurant after a couple of beers, these Russians convinced us for only $500 they would take us in to Russia and show us around. And we thought about it. And then I said, Rob, I don't think we won't come back. Because they said what happens is the Finns all told us. They said they'll take you in there. You'll be pushed out of the car. You won't have your passports with you. The car will be gone. And you'll be stuck in Russia.
Stuck.
Mm-hmm. Trying to figure out how to get home.
I just remember stories of people from that time period who would go to Russia with like a suitcase filled of Levi's jeans and Marlboro cigarettes
and ballpoint pens
and they would trade for things.
Yes.
You know, cigarettes. Like
I got ballpoint pens, protein powder, cigarettes,
Marlboro's, jeans. I mean, you know, you hear about it now, you think to yourself, like, that's sort of insane, but it was going on back then. I mean, we heard it from people. All right, we are going to take a quick break here on the Focus Group. And when we return, we have a business birthday for you and a shop talk, which Tim teased at the beginning of the show about Meta's abandonment of DEI. And they went a step further this weekend. So stay tuned. You'll hear why.
You're listening to the Focus Group with Tim and John. Learn more at focusgroupradio.com.
Thank you.
Now back to the focus group with Tim and John. Available pretty much everywhere.
Hey, welcome back to the focus group. We've got a little bit of a meandering show today, Mr. Nash. I think we're
excited. Oh, I don't know. This could end up being one of our best. We've got psychics, North Korea, a puppet movie. I mean,
spans the globe. And, of course, one of our signature segments we have right now, our business birthday.
Everyone does celebrity birthday greetings, but the Focus Group is the only show in the universe that celebrates business birthdays.
So born this week, actually Thursday, January 16th, is André Jules Michelin. So he was born January 16th, 1853. He died April 4th, 1931 at 78 years old. He was a French industrialist. He and his brother founded the Michelin Tire Company. But they were also involved in publishing the Michelin Guide. And I often wondered whether those two things were related. Did you know anything about the Michelin Guide?
The Michelin Guide was originally this wasn't about dining or restaurants, but it was about road trips. And am I right about that?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. It was about, the hope was they put together this, well, I'll tell you the story, but they put together the guide with the hope that people would travel more in their cars.
That's
which
it.
Would make
That's
them it. Have to get more tires. So, you know,
there's
so,
always a reason, right?
Right, way ahead of their time. So in 1886, André Michelin abandoned his career as a successful Parisian engineer, and he took over his grandfather's failing agricultural business and farm equipment business. So he and his brother in. They didn't know what to do. The company was insolvent. It wasn't doing well. But they had, in terms of building some agricultural products, he also did vulcanized rubber products for belts, valves, and pipes. And so they were trying to figure out if there was something they could do with this rubber rather than some of the old agricultural equipment. And one day in 1889, I thought a U.S. cyclist comes wandering in to the Michelin Company and approached Edward, his brother, with a flat tire, and he was seeking assistance for his bike. And he said that one of the issues with getting flat tires was the frequency of our getting them frequently was it would often leave the cyclist stranded because it took too long to get them repaired. And there was no easy way to get the tires off the bike frames. So in the late 1880s, they said that cycling had become more popular as a form of transportation and a hobby, due in large part to John Dunlop. You remember the Dunlop tires?
Yep.
Because he had invented the inflatable bicycle tire. So before the invention, bicycle tires were made out of solid rubber, which they said gave little traction. They were also very uncomfortable. So when this guy wanders into the Michelins, they decided, well, let's try to make these bike tires. But one thing we're going to do is try to figure out how to create a way to detach the wheel quickly from the front or the back so that they just weren't bolted in. So it was easy to do these levers, which you, I guess, now know of, right? You've changed many tires on your bike.
Oh, yeah.
So they conducted a number of experiments and ended up with a prototype and were granted a patent for the detachable tire in 1891. And so coupled with their tire business for automobiles, they also had the tire business for cycling. They said in 1900, Michelin published the first Michelin Guide, the purpose of which was to promote tourism by car, as you said, supporting the tire manufacturing operation. And the thought was that they gave away these free copies, or 35,000 the first time they did this in 1900. But there were only about 3,000 cars on the road in France at the time. So they decided, aside from these, you know, going on car tours or whatever, that they would provide maps, repair shops, replacement instructions if your car broke down, mechanics listings, hotels, and petrol stations just throughout France. And so while they had some limited success as they gave this away, they said one day André Michelin was in a repair shop and he looked and noticed that a bunch of the Michelin guides were just used to prop up a work table to level it off. And so he said he took the principle of man only truly respects what he pays for. So at that moment, he decided he wasn't going to give the guide away for free anymore and started charging for it. So this was back in 1903 or something. They started charging $2.15 in U.S. for the guide. So they said by 1922, they added restaurants. And I didn't know this, but it was only done in France and Paris. And then a few other places around the world, Algeria, Spain, Belgium.
Which would be like connected to France somehow.
Right. And so they... So they ended up taking advertising out, and they just had this very simple guide. They said it wasn't until 2005, this is what surprised me, the very first Michelin guide in the U.S. didn't come until 2005. And it covered 500 restaurants in New York City and 50 hotels in Manhattan. And you had to pay to be in the guide. I didn't realize that. So it's a, so when they say that you got a star or whatever, it's certainly the ultimate pay to play.
Pay to play.
Because yeah. unless you pay... Now, do you have any idea what it would cost to go into the Michelin Guide?
Why do I think it's kind of like $2,000 a page or $3,000 a page?
Well, it'd be very low.
$10,000
if you thought that. So in 2005 it was New York City, as I said. Then in 2022 they went to Florida. In Florida alone, the restaurants combined in Miami, Orlando, and Tampa had to pay $1.5 million to be included in the guide.
Wow.
In 2023, the guide expanded to Colorado, and they really just did the high-end resorts, Aspen, Beaver Creek, Denver, Snowmass, Vail. Each restaurant or each town had to pay $100,000 to be included in the guide. They added a number of other locales around Colorado, but they said Fort Collins, Grand Junction, Aurora, a few others declined to be in the guide. And Atlanta in 2023 just went into the guide with a payment of $1 million.
Wow.
So it was funny because I always thought when they said, oh, it's got a 2-star rating or a 3-star rating in the Michelin guide, is this supposed to be kind of the arbiter or, you know, mm-hmm. of not only taste, but good restaurants, so forth, so on. But then when you find out you have to pay to be in it, it's kind of like the Motor Trend Car of the Year, right? You only win if you pay, you buy advertising. So your car of the year if you buy enough advertising. So this was the same sort of thing, I guess. But these Michelin guides are still going, very profitable. And I've never used one. I've never gotten
neither
one.
Neither have I. No.
So.
But you know what I love about, there's a couple things. It starts with rubber and tires, right?
Yep.
And cycling. You know, that's the my little thing. And then such a French name. His middle name is Jules, right?
Jules.
And if any sci-fi fans would know that famous French writer Jules Verne, of course, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you know, all the books that he wrote, Around the World in 80 Days. So that must have been a popular French name. Jules must have been, there was a period of time when that must have been like a popular boy's name, I guess, right?
The name, André Jules.
But what a great business birthday.
And still making tires.
And still make and coin.
Yeah.
All right. Coin and
they're based, I believe, in South Carolina now, in the U.S. is where they're based.
Makes sense.
Our friend John actually interviewed with them. Remember from Subaru, he interviewed
for a job at
Michelin.
Yeah, okay.
Thought he was going to get it. We all were excited about it, but I think he knew Italian more than French.
Yeah, maybe Nancy Mace got it. I don't want transgendered bathrooms in your plan. You can see that. Yeah.
Well, it worked out well for him because he's in a blue state now. So
yeah. But anyway, there you go.
So hey, our shop talk today, and John had mentioned teased it before our quick break, and we used it in the beginning of our tease with Meta bows to MAGA, is around Mark Zuckerberg, who is head of Facebook or Meta, and the new guidelines that are included now. And what they're calling a carve out to allow anti-LGBTQ speech on Facebook and Instagram, as well as essentially taking the guardrails off of everything as I read this article. It says, according to the new guidelines, this came from CNN, it says, according to the new Meta guidelines, which otherwise prohibit the use of insults on the online platforms, we do allow allegations of mental illness or abnormality when based on gender or sexual orientation, given political and religious discourse about transgenderism and homosexuality, and common non-serious usage of words like weird. So essentially, they're going to allow users to call LGBTQ people out as being mentally ill, but also going after women, going after race, going after gender. Right? It's shocking to me. I don't know if
I'll say this. Did you see him speak about this at all?
A little bit with his goofy haircut and his little necklace.
Yeah, because now he's like he's jacked up. He does boxing and kickboxing and all this crap, and he's really deep into this idea that corporations need to be more masculine, get your masculine energy back. And I know it might, he said, I know it might be offensive to women. Stop right there. Anyway, he said something about this, which I think should be a warning to everyone. He said, you know what? If you can say it on the floor of the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House of Representatives, then why couldn't it be said on Facebook? So this idea
is that what he said, and he
actually had references he referred to times when members of the House have said, and we've watched some of these crazy speeches on C-SPAN and stuff. His logic is sort of correct in that, you know, if they're doing it and they're the people that run the country, how come you're saying that we can't do it? I mean, it's a half-assed way of bowing and kissing the ring and doing all the MAGA crap that you were talking about before, but. It made me pause because, you know, we have people always say what politicians say have a direct effect on behavior and on people. And sometimes you brush it off. But here you have a billionaire and one of the owners of one of the largest social media platforms in the world basically saying, well, if they could say it on the floor of the Congress, why can't you say it on Facebook? So I'm curious as to what's going to start happening if people start using the N-word rather liberally. And is this going to, because if it's race, gender, sexual preference, you're opening up this whole, it's going to be a non-funny Rodney Dangerfield times 100, right?
Right. Well, minorities, you know, how he's married to an Asian woman. Mm-hmm. So he has biracial kids. So I'm shocked by this because there really is no guardrails, and we all know what a shit show X turned into, or Twitter.
Oh, it's a dumpster fire. It's rolling down the street on fire. Yeah.
So I'm wondering, this almost looks like this is going to be, you know, times 100 because there's so many more people on Facebook.
Biggest platform. Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, you know, we have a lot of our show. We have the Focus Group with Tim Bennett and John Nash. We have Focus Group Radio all through Facebook. And I'm wondering if we need to migrate, like a lot of people are, over to Blue Sky, or do you keep both, or do you wait and see?
I don't know. I would say I'm not sure about migrating. I would love to check out Blue Sky. I have, in fact, been on the platform a couple times, and I'm not lying when I say this. It's oddly refreshing because there's a lot of positivity, a lot of interesting articles. I came across a thing about cathedrals in Europe, and then underneath that was a cat on a Roomba, you know, like stuff that makes you smile, you learn. I go on to X fairly regularly to look for, it used to have a lot more funny stuff. Now it kind of doesn't. And it's a lot of, like the LA wildfire, the fires in California have been predominant with insane conspiracy theories about what happened, about some escaped convict from Massachusetts from a blue state goes and does something, you know. You have to work really hard to connect those kind of dots. How about it's Occam's razor? The simplest explanation must be true, and that is 105 mile an hour winds. If holding a fire next to a turbofan is going to cause trouble, but you know, let's not be logical. I think that the problem I would see with Meta doing this is how many kids are on the platform, how many parents are monitoring that. How many like people in general use it to have like a knitting circle? You know, there's a lot of benign uses for Facebook, but if this stuff starts popping up in your feed, if I were an advertiser, and Tim, you and I have been in the industry for years, would you say to a client at this point in time, like, you know, you might want to back off Facebook spending?
I probably would, only because we also know how many fake profiles there are out there on Facebook.
Tons,
you know, I think they
profiles.
Say they've got 1.2 billion users, but I think, you know, 1 billion of them are fake. which is a big issue. I mean, you and I know a couple of brands that actually tried to do what they thought were big programs, digital programs through Facebook, and had a horrible return in terms of click-through or engagement. Our numbers are okay. We do better in some other places, but I just wondered, maybe we'll try to do, I think I have a placeholder for us for Focus Group on Blue Sky, but maybe you set up both and see what happens. Because we didn't disengage, but we just don't post anymore on X. We still have our
Facebook page.
Oh, a lot of people do, but they just don't use them because it's...
Like Subaru stopped in 2023 or 2022.
They whenever he bought the platform.
Yeah. Yeah. So a number of brands have done that as well. So, you know, maybe we'll see what happens. But I'm concerned because exactly what you said, do you start creeping in with the inappropriate language and just, you know, calling somebody mentally ill or picking on trans people? I mean, it's just, it's just opens up a floodgate of as you said, nastiness, which is what's happened on X. I mean, some of the language on X, you read it and you just shake your head.
I close the app and I'm like, you know, I know better. Why do I do this? Why do I hit the button? I know better. Yeah. It's going to disappoint me. This is just, and a lot of this issue with Meta, with Facebook, I don't know that Instagram is going to, Instagram's kind of different than Facebook, right? I mean, it's picture and video based. It's not as political sometimes. I just, you know, all these tech companies hide behind that cop. What is that? That rule? I forget the number. It's, you know, that they're technically, they provide a platform for people to, and they're not responsible for what happens on the platform.
Free speech.
And this is, you know, I love when people throw free speech around because there are guardrails to free speech. It's been defined by a number of court cases, constitutional cases.
Right.
And I'm not so sure it's a bad thing to restrict language that we know that's been proven by science, been proven by research, been proven by parents to be harmful to others. There was an article that I read in, I was at Slate or The Atlantic, and the author said that he began putting longer form, or he began posting articles, I think it was on X and Facebook. And he said he was shocked and he was deeply wounded by the negativity that he encountered. He said by the most benign things, like he would write about wildlife, something weird, and he'd get this nasty stuff. He said one day he decided to figure out who was sending all these nasty comments. And he picked three and he began a forensic, you know, backtracking of who these people were. And he discovered that of the three, two of these people were like teenagers. And he said I'll tell you truthfully, the one was a 17-year-old and one was an 18-year-old. And he said, and that's when I just kind of thought to myself, I'm just going to ignore all this because what does a teenager know? You know, if the brain is not fully formed until you're 25, why would I be listening to some negative crap from a teenager? And right. where are they? You know, and he said, and these are the people who often have the time to clack, 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 clack the replies out.
What I find most disheartening as well is that in advertising particular, you can't say something that's not true.
Correct.
You have to have third party substantiation. So you can't say your car can do X or this product is going to do Y or whatever without third party proof and testing. And so you just can't say things to say them. And there seems to be nobody monitoring. I guess this is what Congress was upset about overall with social media platforms. Is that there does appear to be no rules, no guardrails to it. And so you can kind of say whatever you want, and it's okay. But can you say that in the newspaper? So could the Washington Post or the New York Times now just say what they want anymore?
No, because there are, in fact, rules about that. So print media, television, you cannot make claims that are not fact-based. If you do, you're open to defamation lawsuits. Right. So these guys are shielded because, again, thanks to this law that was passed, I want to say it was maybe even during Bill Clinton's presidency, they would never have foreseen this problem. But basically, they're platforming the information. But because they're platforming it doesn't mean they're the ones doing it. So they're not liable legally for defamation or for hurting other people.
So even though the American American Psychiatric Association says removed homosexuality as a mental illness. 50 years ago, you could still say it now you can say it on Facebook and get no responsibility for saying it and or no repercussions.
And, you know, Tim, the broader thing that I'm just struck by repeatedly, and you said this to something else we were talking about before we recorded the show today, history repeats itself. And this particular history about demonizing the LGBTQ community, you and I have lived through at least two or three cycles of this. And it's tiring, it's boring, it's disgusting. And frankly, the America that I grew up in, that my granddad taught me about, this is the most un-American thing I could ever tell you. I mean, I was taught, and I've said this before, and I know it sounds corny, but when you meet in the public square, you're an American. It doesn't matter what church you go to. It doesn't matter your orientation or your gender. You're an American first. And I think that's gone. I don't know. Do you run it? Like, I that was something to be proud of, too. You're a proud citizen of the United States of America. Now, it's this tribal thing. Either you're a certain kind of American. Do you have a, like, we fly a flag at our country house. I love the flag, right?
Yeah.
Our neighbor, though, and Bob's jealous because our neighbor put a flagpole up, and now Bob wants a flagpole. I like Todd's flagpole. It looks good. But Todd, who used to serve, I think he was in the Navy, he said he had a real thought process about putting up a flagpole. He said, because nowadays when you fly the flag, you're actually signaling something different than you're a proud American. And he was referring, of course, to the pickup trucks going by with the Trump, yeah, you know, and the American flags. So this to me, do you ever watch the movie The Social Network about Facebook, yeah, and the Winklevoss, yeah, twins and the whole bit? And this is, and here's Mark Zuckerberg today, right? Well, yeah, you know,
and just as a kind of put a fine point on it, there was also a story companion piece to this that just says that Meta is also ending all its DEI programs, which is similar to what we've heard from internally, Nissan and Harley Davidson, blah blah blah, Walmart, and they've essentially axed their entire DEI team. The company's chief diversity officer, right, is going to be in a new role called accessibility and engagement. They're not going to hire, are using DEI standards, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion, and hiring practices. But they are still going to try to help small businesses, I guess, in terms of.
Okay.
As a vendor.
And then can you tell me that some of their, because of this new speech thing, a lot of the LGBTQ employees of Facebook have been calling out sick because they're mentally ill.
Mentally illness. Yeah, mental illness day. So who knows? We're heading into, as we head into inauguration day, we're heading into some new territory. I think one thing for certain is there's going to be chaos. Just every day you wake up and, you know, what happened today? Because you got to be in the news, John. If you're not in the news, somebody else is.
And so there you go. We all grew up with presidents who were pretty quiet on a day-to-day, yes, basis. Congress did this.
Enjoy the calm right now. Enjoy the calm before the storm.
Because this guy wants your attention 100%. 100%. Yep. Well, there you go, folks. Thank you for joining us today on the Focus Group. I want to remind you that we also have a companion podcast called TFG Unbuttoned. And you can find all of this at focusgroupradio.com, including our partners and sponsors, one of which is Deep Discount, who's been with us here on the Focus Group from the start. You can visit them by going to our site, focusgroupradio.com, and clicking on the Deep Discount logo and starting your shopping extravaganza. Believe me, there's a lot to check out there. It's games. Tim, in fact, you were looking at board games the other day, right? Were you thinking of getting like Candyland or Clue?
Chutes and Ladders.
Okay. Hey, so, you know, here on the Focus Group, I want to remind people that we don't want you to text and drive. We want you to arrive alive. I'll just say this quick. Yesterday, I was driving into the city, and a minivan was drifting almost into the car. And as we passed, it was someone on a phone. They had the phone at the steering wheel. And I'm like, okay, you know, you can't do those two things at the same time. Driving requires your complete attention. So
do you blow the horn at him?
I didn't, and then Bob yelled at me for not blowing the horn.
I blow the horn and get the finger.
So now I'm going to start blowing the horn. All right, so everybody have a great week, and we'll see you here next week on The Focus Group.
It's The Focus Group with Tim Bennett and John Nash. Accessible on all platforms. Subscribe, like, and rate us on your platform of choice. Learn more at focusgroupradio.com.
That was a stunning Focus Group.